Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative. Kia ora, Eric.
Good evening.
Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you were living in Christchurch when that terrible, what was actually technically an aftershock, took place back in 2011.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because, it's horrible, but backstory, where I grew up in Canada was part of the underlying bedrock was Canadian Shield, right? It's some of the most geologically stable parts of the planet, that in the middle of Australia. So we'd never felt anything like an earthquake before. February 22nd was a bit of a shock. Then we'd gone through all of the pre-shocks to it. But I was in my office at Canterbury University, fifth floor, and I was getting ready to go for lunch. The student groups are having their orientation week and their student recruitment drive, and I was having lunch with the head of one of the student groups, the student clubs. And I got real lucky because that morning I'd gotten a phone call from CTV. They were interested in some of the copyright aspects of the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, and I'd been writing a little bit on that, and they wanted me to come in for an interview at 1 p.m. So I'm generally a little bit early for things, and had I not made prior arrangements for lunch, I probably would have been at the building. But I'd kind of punted saying, well, I've got this lunch that I can't really miss.
Heavens, I didn't know that, Eric.
Yes, so I got a bit lucky there.
Yeah.
I
mean, one of the stories on Fragments, which is Katie Gossett's series that we've just started, we started episode one was last night, was, I guess it was a bit similar. It was even more of a twist of fate. It was a decision to go to the dairy before going back to work that saved this particular speaker's life, most probably.
It's like that picture that goes around of the World War II bomber, right? That you only see the ones where the holes weren't on critical parts. So you're only hearing the stories from the people who got lucky. We don't get to hear the stories from ones where the twist of fate went the other way.
No. But you chose to come here to Wellington. When you go back to Christchurch and you look at the rebuild, how do you think that city's done?
Well, when I'd left in 2014, Christchurch was a pretty depressing place. It wasn't so much the earthquakes and the rapidly declining number of aftershocks. You weren't really getting them anymore by the time I'd left. It was rather the series of policy errors that you could just see the disaster coming, of things that they weren't putting in place to let downtown grow again, to let people have houses again. Now, Selwyn and Waimak did step up. We got a lot more housing out in those parts. But immediately after the earthquakes, there were all kinds of things that could have been done to alleviate a pretty terrible situation that weren't done. And then subsequent to that, just successions of policy changes that made it really, really hard for property owners downtown to have any sense of what they were really allowed to do.
This was mostly under a national-led government.
Absolutely.
Which one would have thought would have been more concerned about not getting in the way of business.
Well, I think it was less policy direction out of politicians and maybe a little bit more of the direction coming out of the bureaus, although, of course, better direction from the politicians could have helped. And you hear stories about things having been held up an awful long time on one particular minister's desk that hindered some parts of recovery. But
was there an over-reliance on anchor projects?
Absolutely. So,
and by that I mean big convention centers or whatever they were, getting those going and then everything would follow. Maybe we had to get the little stuff going quicker. Faster.
I think that there's been a strongly emerging consensus around that. So I was saying those kinds of things in 2014 around the time I was leaving. James Dan, who's been a commentator on Christchurch issues for some time, had a piece in Slate just this week also talking about the importance of recognizing that cities are kind of organic and need to be able to grow on their own rather than being forced into precincts that are pretty artificial and don't wind up working. So the sequence of events that we'd had was we had this share of an idea process where people gave their grand visions of what they thought downtown should look like that resulted in a plan that I think central government viewed as putting too many costs on central government because it was expecting central to come to the table with a lot more funding for a lot more things that people in Christchurch thought were nice. And it's not really reasonable to go to central government with that kind of an ask unless they've already signaled that they're willing to spend that. So instead, we got something like commissioners come in to impose a new central plan. And during that whole process, people downtown just had no clue what they could do with their properties again, right? So you had folks like, I documented this. And one of the things that I'd asked Oliver when I came up to Wellington to work with the initiative is that I get to do a bit of work on earthquake policy because it just bothered me so much, the failures that we'd had in Christchurch. And I had terror of what would happen in Wellington if we couldn't start fixing some of this. And it still worries me. But in our report, we talk about it was the Copthorne Hotel, and it was, I think, day 757 after the earthquake, and they were ready with their insurer. They wanted to rebuild, but nobody could tell them whether a hotel was allowable as part of what they were considering to be an arts precinct, whether it was consistent with the vision of an arts precinct that there's a hotel there. You couldn't get certainty around the convention center. So I'm kind of a convention center skeptic, but if you're going to have one of the things, you at least need to say where it's going to be and when it's going to be delivered so that everybody else can make their decisions. Because if you want to have a hotel, you want to be situated near the convention center if you want to service conventioners, right? It's harder to plan when you can't, when you've got just this sheer uncertainty about what decisions the government is going to be coming to, and those all matter for your own planning purposes. So what you wound up seeing was people fleeing the area of downtown uncertainty and the spreading out of businesses out to near the airport and other parts of town. And that's good too. You can have these multimodal cities, but it wasn't particularly good for downtown. Going back there more recently, and I would absolutely wish to defer to people who live there. They've got all of the stake in it. I don't have a stake there anymore. There are some wonderful things going on downtown. The Riverside Market was great. It was throbbing, heaving with people when we were there last winter. That seemed very successful. But there are still parts of downtown that are a wasteland of just surface parking lots, kind of holding areas, waiting for something else.
Now, of course, parking lots can actually be quite a good way of making money. So maybe there's some extent that's just the market. If you've got it's a quick way of starting to get a return on your land. Is that the problem in terms of what could take precedence over a parking space at the moment?
I think it was more a symptom that if you're not quite sure what you want to do with your land yet, having it as a surface parking lot keeps all of your options open. It's easy to build something else on top of that later. So things that would have been vacant lots could very quickly turn into pretty rubbishy, cheap parking lots. And there were a lot of those in 2014 when I'd left, and some of those were pretty clearly just former demolition sites and still bits of jagged things sticking out. You still do see some fairly underused looking land. I think some of that's an artifact of the long time that it took to get certainty around what would be allowed, and then the flight of capital from the downtown.
Now, we just had that detail we broadcast on the RMA. How much of that inertia is to do with the planning legislation that's currently in place here? Anything?
Well, those are kind of different deals. So Christchurch was under its own separate set of rules for the duration of the earthquake, and that enabled some things that were pretty good. You did get some more zoning on the outskirts of town, not nearly as much as could have happened. It's a separate kind of problem. The problem that we're facing more generally is that when councils tend to bear much of the cost of the infrastructure that's necessary to facilitate growth and bear all of the cost of all of the aggro that they face from people who don't see the benefits of change in their community, they don't have much reason to agree to the changes that would allow more housing to come in and reduce homelessness and reduce the cost of housing. Now, you have got a few superheroes in there that'll just barge through regardless and will vote for more housing, allowing people to build in places where people want to live. But it's a hard ask. We shouldn't be demanding that our politicians be heroic in getting towards more housing. We should set up the incentives so that they want to facilitate growth.
Well, and when we have a situation where we've got local councils dealing with infrastructure problems, with the local council here in Wellington, for example, and I begin to wonder whether that's actually what Wellington's dealing with right now is maybe something that a lot of councils are going to have to start to face up to, infrastructure costs. Do we reach a point where really local government can't do all the stuff we expect it to do anymore, and some of the stuff has to go central?
Well, central government is already looking to take the Three Waters infrastructure off of local councils. Whether they'll be successful in that, there'll be a bit of... There's been less fight than I was expecting on it. You've got billions of dollars of assets there that are potentially being taken by central government into their own repositories in these new amalgamated units. And councils being able to run a waterworks also has... some complementarities across other things that councils do, right? So if you're a small council and you would never be able to staff up for a lot of the other things that councils do, but because you're also running a water program, you can afford to have the staff that kind of sit across lots of different areas. Taking the waterworks out of that can cause some problems. I think that the underlying issue, though, is less about thinking that councils shouldn't be running the infrastructure. That seems like core council business. It's more that councils kind of got away from keeping an eye on core business like waterworks renewal, making sure that the underground infrastructure is in good nick, that they're maintaining their depreciation properly, that they're funding renewal on an adequate basis, and that they maintain the debt capacity to lay out new infrastructure to replace old and to extend the network where necessary. Instead, they loaded up with debt on a lot of other things that voters see as pretty nice to have. And then you wind up at your debt limit when you've got a crumbling infrastructure network and all your sewage pipes are breaking, and you're still trying to spend a couple $100 million on a library and more on a convention center.
And at that very same time, councils across the country have been told, you've got to release more land or enable more development, more housing development in your patches.
Yeah. So we're in this terrible spot where local... We've been in this for a long time, and I think we've talked about it a few times. Central government does benefit a lot with population growth. Local government doesn't. Central government tells local government to accommodate it. Local government bears the cost. So they say no, or they don't say no directly. They just fail to do it. Central government thinks that local governments are idiots, tries to look for a bigger, dirtier stick to hit them with next time to force them into doing things. Local councils find new ways of avoiding doing things that are costly to them. Now, there are some bits that have usefully come in since the Labor government came in. The National Policy Statement on Urban Development is a nice move. It does require more upzoning in places where people want to live, but it still doesn't provide councils with some of the ways of accommodating the costs of that. So some of the infrastructure financing legislation that's come through isn't particularly suitable for brownfield sites like the ones that would be hit by the NPS urban development.
Is it easier for a council to just let development happen on the edge of town? In other words, what we call greenfield development. Is there less cost involved in that or more?
It's going to depend on the particularities of any council, right? It'll depend on how close your trunk infrastructure is to needing to be upgraded anyway. So if you've got a piece of pipe that needs to be upgraded anyway, making a bigger capacity pipe there doesn't cost that much more. And that can facilitate a lot of upzoning in places where you're laying out that new pipe. But it depends on all of the connections, and that'll be very site specific.
And if you're thinking about developing in already developed areas, a lot of people might push back against that. The NIMBYs, as they are called. Now, you've been thinking about that too, Eric, and a possible solution that you picked up in Britain.
Oh, there's a neat report that had come out from Policy Exchange late last week. So it wouldn't be the full solution. There's a lot of important stuff going on, and even more important stuff that isn't going on, that's also necessary to get us towards better outcomes. But it's a neat idea to think about as part of a solution. So what Policy Exchange proposed was that if a supermajority of people on a street, so they'll define a street as being like the area between one side of a block, basically, right? So if you've got a small block, then that's fine. If it's too small, then you might need to have a different kind of a mechanism. But say that you've got a block where you've got 20 houses on one side of the street. If you've got the residents of 12 of those houses all agreeing to an upzoning, so you need a 60% majority, and you need at least a... person in 50% of the houses to be agreeing, then they can agree on their own upzoning plan. So they can master plan their own street and shift it from something, say, like single family dwellings to terraced housing, or something that even looks like Paris with the five stories that are all contiguous and they're all butt up and ended against each other, and great apartments, right? If they do that, there will be some potential infrastructure costs for council, but there is just so much gravy left over in the value that's unlocked by putting land to better valued use and selling off all those extra apartments. So in that kind of a setup, you'd imagine that the 20 houses in the streets, they take the top 20 apartments in that set of houses, and you've still got a few more top-level apartments to sell off and all of the lower ones. Some of the money from that funds the infrastructure. Done. Easy, right? And it's done by the agreement of the people on that street. So instead of a few NIMBYs being able to block development in their whole community, as you'd see in Kendall every time I go to one of the town hall meetings there, they'd only be able to block it on their own particular street and only if enough of their neighbors agreed with them, right? And that's not so bad if you've got other streets that see, wow, I could live in a house that's almost as big as now. It'd be a lot more modern. It'd be up to date. It wouldn't need the roof replaced as my current roof needs to be replaced. And I'd have $500,000 sitting in my bank account. That sounds like a pretty good deal, right? Letting people come to that by agreement with their neighbors seems like it could be a useful part of a solution. I don't think it can solve everything, but adding that on top of everything else that we're doing, just giving the option for people on a street to come to their own agreement, to upzone themselves and to unlock that value, improve their neighborhood. And the nice thing also with requiring agreement is, well, people like the neighborhood that they wind up being in, right? They've agreed on the design standards.
Would we need some kind of legislation through Parliament to make this possible? Could we do this as a trial somewhere and see if it works?
Well, it would be wonderful to do it as a trial. Right now, it would be, if it's inconsistent with the current plan, you wouldn't be able to do it, right? It'd be pretty tough. So the way that they've got it set up in the UK version, they'd have if 20% of the people on the street propose that kind of a plan, then council takes it, makes sure that it's consistent with the rules for these things, and then sends it back to the people on that street for a formal vote. And if the vote passes, then it's enacted. So council has a role there and then making sure that the infrastructure costs are covered out of some of the value uplift that happens with that redevelopment. It'd be wonderful to be able to see that kind of thing trialed. I think we make far too little use of policy trials and experimentation and letting one city try something to see if it works and then maybe roll it out elsewhere.
Eric, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative, back with more largely libertarian thoughts in around about 2.5 months. By the way, the link, we've got a link on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/nights, to the policy exchange proposal Eric was just talking about there.